From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. David Brower was uncompromising about the environment. At least, that's where he ended up, in a life devoted to it. In his new book, the journalist Robert Wiss calls Brower an angry trailblazer who transformed environmentalism from hiking and birdwatching into a social force. Brower built the Sierra Club. He was a genius at marketing. He was eloquent and charismatic, but also combative and arrogant. In the book, Wiss argues Brower's unyielding disposition may have cost him friends and lost battles for the cause, but he also wonders if the modern environmental movement hasn't lost sight of his passionate brand of advocacy. We're talking with Robert Wiss today about David Brower's complicated and paradoxical life. After the news.
Hey, you. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You probably know the name David Brower because of the things he accomplished. As head of the Sierra Club, he helped invent the modern environmental movement. He changed the focus from camping and hiking to real activism. He fought the building of dams on important sections of land. He argued for wilderness protection. He won some, he lost some. And in his new book, the journalist Robert Wiss wonders what else Brower could have accomplished if he could have just gotten out of his own way. He was a control freak. He was opinionated. He came to be uncompromising. But along with all of that, he was also a visionary willing to take risks. He was passionate and bold, and in some ways, Wiss says the modern environmental movement could use another person like him today. Today in the program, Robert Wiss is joining us to talk about David Brower. His book is called The Man Who Built the Sierra Club, A Life of David Brower. He's joining us from the studios of Connecticut Public Broadcasting in Hartford. Robert Wiss is a professor of journalism at the University of Connecticut. He's written for the New York Times, Christian Science Monitor, Smithsonian, a number of others. Robert Wiss, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's wonderful to be able to talk to one of my favorite people about David Brower.
Well, I want to start with this, like why you wanted to do this, why you wanted to, because you mentioned how there has been a lot of writing about David Brower. So what did you figure you could add to all of this? I mean, in the introduction, you say that some of the writing about Brower over the years has kind of failed to capture the complexity and the paradox of him.
You know, there's been a lot of writing about David Brower, but most of it was really short-form journalism. It was newspaper articles or magazine articles. Mm-hmm. You know, the one definitive book was John McPhee's book, which was Encounters with the Archdruid. Now, that book came out first in magazine form in The New Yorker and then as a book in 1970 or 71. So that was a long, long time ago. There have been some documentary films about him, but As I looked at the landscape as somebody who as a journalist has covered environment for many years, I was always kind of perplexed that somebody hadn't taken another look at Brower in a more comprehensive way since McPhee had. And it just happened that I had a sabbatical coming up at the university, and it just happened to be that Brower's papers were in Berkeley. And so things just kind of came together so I could spend several months in the Bay Area in Berkeley discovering and exploring the life of David Brower.
When did you, as you started looking into it, when did you find a theme? It seems like there is an important one here, and that is that movement away from compromise. He got bitten, and we'll talk about that, of course, as we go. But then it's so interesting because maybe this is the paradox that you referred to, that on one hand he learned his lesson not to compromise, that may have cost him opportunities, but it's also the thing the environmental movement may need today. Am I getting that sort of right?
Yeah, I mean that's certainly one of the themes, and it was the one that probably people have explored the most. But you know what I found is that I found him a far more complex individual than I ever dreamt he would be. Now, I read tremendous amounts of stuff before I got to Berkeley about Brower, and there was kind of a theme in what I read that essentially he was the rebel for the Sierra Club who just became too radical, too uncompromising, and he lost his job there. And I found out that was overly simplified because it was more complex. He had these terrific fights with the board, and they didn't all have to do with political issues. They had to do with management issues, financial issues, things like that. Ansel Adams, who had a father-son relationship with David Brower, was the one who finally led the movement to fire David Brower in 1969. And it wasn't really politics. It was insubordination and financial mismanagement.
Mm-hmm. We'll come back to that story. I think that relationship is really interesting. But I want to back up, and I guess it's hard to pinpoint the moment anyone becomes, you know, captivated or converted to something, but it seems like a summer trip that David Brower took with his family to Yosemite when he was just 6 years old was kind of important in what he would do later in his life.
Yeah, I mean, the Sierras, the mountains, Yosemite were always one of the most important threads that you will find in his life. Now, when he first took that trip, he was actually afraid to go on the trails and that sort of thing. But eventually, by the time he was a young man, he spent much of his 20s as a mountain climber, as an elite mountain climber, as a guy who on the Sierras alone had something like 33 first ascents, and who wrote articles in the Saturday Evening Post and elsewhere about his conquest of mountains.
His father was an engineer and an electrician. He was friendly, good at fixing things. His mom was smart and kind of, I guess, remarkable for the time. She was really educated, got a master's degree from Stanford. So what was life like at home, do you figure, for Brower? I mean, it was pretty rigid. There was kind of this puritanical strain that his grandmother and his father had. Didn't have any effect on him, but I wonder what the impact of all of – what was his upbringing like in that sense?
It was a very upper middle class upbringing at the beginning. I mean, they had an automobile earlier than what most people would have. That Yosemite trip that you mentioned, they took a car and drove all the way on these little dirt roads. But it all changed around 1920 when his mother, shortly after giving birth to the youngest child, Joe, is stricken with, I think it was a stroke. It's not quite clear. It's never been made clear, who was stricken and really seriously, seriously incapacitated. She went blind. She would have these terrible attacks. About the same time, his father lost his job at Berkeley, and they did have some real estate. They had two apartment buildings, one of which they were living in. And so he became the permanent landlord for those buildings and really the caretaker who took care of both the children and the mom.
David, his mother lost her sight through that brain tumor. And so you say in the book that Brower's writing seems influenced by that experience, that he described going on these hikes with her and becoming her eyes. Did you sense something important about that experience for him?
Well, I mean, he was the one who talked about this, and he talked about it rather poetically. And what he said was he learned the power of descriptive language, because they would go up into the hills of Berkeley, which weren't covered with houses in those days, were just totally wilderness, and he would describe as they went along what they were seeing, and it certainly built and helped him grow as someone who would later become a very good writer and a very good speaker in talking about the power and beauty of the nature and the environment.
It was interesting. You say that David Brower had to help care for the children in the family when his mother was eventually died and was incapacitated. And you write that the kids lacked what was called at the time social graces. Explain that. I think that's interesting. I mean, his disposition. I'm trying to get a sense of the David Brower who could be really brusque and incredibly shy. How that was maybe informed by that early part of his life.
Well, you know, to a certain extent, there was no mom. There was no one there to smooth out the rough edges. It was probably a fairly masculine family that we're talking about. And to a certain extent, it was difficult at times for David or for the other siblings to be in the house because the mom could often be in pain. And at other times, she became extremely religious and strident in her religion, and she'd turn the radio and it would be rather loud. And it was a raucous, unusual, different kind of household and upraising for that particular, as far as we're talking about.
Yeah. I want to ask you about his butterfly collecting, which I was kind of fascinated by. He's 13 years old and he discovers butterflies and collecting them, and he really, really took to it.
He really did. There were a couple tenants in one of the apartments, and they were kids, and they were about his age, and they were into collecting butterflies. And so they took him out one day, and he became hooked. And it was he loved it. He got to go roam the hills of Berkeley, and he would chase these butterflies. And he was a little bit of a loner in those days.
Yeah.
And so that was fine to be up in the hills by himself. However, if anybody ever came along who saw him with the butterfly net, he was suddenly very, very self-conscious about it and would kind of pretend that, you know, he didn't have the net, and he'd start humming a popular tune or something like that because he was rather embarrassed. But he did put together a fairly extensive butterfly collection, which, by the way, is still at the – or elements of it are still at the Bancroft Library as part of his overall papers and collections.
Wow. I want to ask you about the image on the cover of the book. This is David Brower doing some climbing. It's a great image. He was 21 when he took to climbing. How did he find mountain climbing?
There was one summer he went up, and he and a friend decided they were going to hike various portions of the Sierra. And they were hiking along, and they started to get adventuresome, and they started to go up some of the cliffs and climb some of the peaks. And at one point, he slips. Then he bumps into one of the elite mountain climbers of the era and realizes who the guy is and spends an evening talking to him and learning a tremendous amount. And then he spends another few weeks hiking. And this all leads him eventually to joining the Sierra Club, which is a hiking club based in San Francisco. But as a group of young men, and by the way, there were a number of young women who were mountain climbers. And so that's really how he gets his start as a mountain climber.
You say that Brower wasn't so interested in getting to the top when he climbed. He liked solving the puzzle to get to the top.
Right. That was a reflection he said, and I think that I don't remember which mountain that was, but he was enamored about the idea of getting his name on these first ascents. And there's these stories about him pinning up maps of the Sierra on his ceiling of his little room in Berkeley and staring at it and putting little notations that he climbed this particular peak and he climbed this particular peak. And he was very, very meticulous in recording what were first ascents.
Driven by ego? Is that fair to say?
Probably. You know, it was a time in his life. His 20s were a time of where he was trying to find himself, I guess I would say. Yeah. It was the Depression, okay? Jobs were hard to find. He would want to spend every summer in the Sierras doing things, hiking or doing whatever he could do. And so it was difficult to hold down a job if you're going to go every summer. So He rarely had a job until finally Ansel Adams helped him out and got him a job up in Yosemite, which we can talk about if you want to in a moment. But it probably did stroke his ego at a time when there weren't a lot of other things to stroke David Brower's ego.
Frustratingly independent is how you describe him. As I mentioned earlier, shy in some personal situations. He could also be brusque. But he was a risk taker. Would you talk a little bit about that? Because it seems like that idea of taking risks, of being willing to gamble, climbing mountains, and later in his activism, what was that about in terms of his character, his personality?
Well, see, this is one of the things that I really thought I mean, when I found this and when I explored this, I really found this as one of the major premises of his life. And this is what made him in some ways so distinctive, because he was willing to take gambles and to take risks, to do crazy things that other people would not do. And we see this throughout his professional life. We see this throughout his personal life. Just to move a little forward in the chronology, we can come back to the chronology if you want to. But David Brower was married for 57 years.
Yeah.
He had 4 children. He was also bisexual, which was a secret. Now, he had affairs with men, and he had the affairs beginning in the 40s and extending until the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, throughout. Now, today, being bisexual, being homosexual, is we don't think anything of it, or most of us don't think anything of it. But in the 1950s, this was an incredible risk to take. I mean, here he is, the head of the Sierra Club, the head of an elite conservation organization, working in Congress at a time when if people discover this secret, and it was a closely held secret known to his friends but not everybody, it would have destroyed his career. It would have absolutely destroyed his career, and it might have destroyed the Sierra Club for that matter, to have somebody who was felt in those days to be having deviant behavior. But this is what I mean about the risk-taking, the gambles. I mean, he did things that a lot of us would at least, you know, think a long, hard time about before we would go out and do them.
So what do you make of that? Was that recklessness? Was that a lack of accountability? Was that just a bisexual or gay man trying to live out his sexuality? I mean, this was interesting. You write in the book, and you just mentioned he was bisexual. You say his sexual interests, which it seems like his first relations came when he was in the Army. He was in the 10th Mountain Division of the Army. And you say that sexual interest would not have been unusual at that time. You mentioned these historians who say that the war could sort of disrupt traditional gender patterns. But you also write about the fact that he was incredibly awkward with women. He had this discomfort. He had this kind of strange courtship with Anne, the woman who became his wife, and we can talk about that later. But are you sure he was bisexual, or was he just a closeted gay man?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell as far as what. I mean, he obviously had relations with Anne and probably no other woman. He then also had relations with men. It's difficult to unravel, and I didn't go too far pursuing the sexual history. But at the same time, I had to spend a fair amount of time trying to understand sexuality and bisexuality and homosexuality. And so you see some of those references to what historians said about young men who went in the Army during World War II and were together in barracks, and some of them discovered apparently at that time they were had a homosexual tendency. Had to spend a lot of time, though, talking to a lot of people about this and struggling and just where it belonged and how it belonged in the book.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it's not an important, you know, thread in the book. It's something I tell people about. But at the same time, as I've thought about it, I do think it does reflect a lot of what he was willing to do. And I don't think the sexuality was driving some of the professional gambles that he made. There's just something in David Brower that would push him to do things that other people just would not do. And I think that's partially what made David Brower so great. And I think that's partially what was the weaknesses that David Brower had at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Were there any who said to you, Bob, what's the point in bringing this up? You don't need to mention that he had affairs with men and, you know, that. I mean, did anyone push back on that as you were talking to people about all of this?
A small minority of people did think it did not belong in the book. But I talked to a lot of people. I went way out of my way. And it was something that I and the editors discussed in some detail. It's a book put out by Columbia University Press. They use internal reviewers. They had four professional reviewers. It went to the reviewers. They were all asked this question. They all agreed. They weren't one or two of them weren't crazy about the secret. Well, there was one who knew Brower pretty well, who knew the secret, who was sad to hear it come out. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, that we all agreed that you could not really write a full biography about David Brower without putting this in. And yeah. I think that's been one of the problems in the past with the news stories, the magazines, that there it was kind of a shallow sort of story about David Brower in the past.
In 1952, you report that Brower was he's having some success with the Sierra Club. They've entrusted him to go take people on these trips, which is this big honor. But then around this time, it was alleged that he had made sexual advances to, I guess, as I understand it, a black man at a gymnasium on the campus of the University of California in Berkeley. And the story came to light many years later, you say, when Brower was having difficulty with the Sierra Club board and there were accusations made. What part did this kind of, I guess you could call it a scandal, what part did this play in the story of his life, do you think?
Well, it wasn't well known. It was kept pretty hush-hush. It was pretty quiet. There was a complaint made to the University of California, and whoever the administrators were passed it on to the UC Press that Mr. Brower would have to go. The editor at the time didn't really want Brower to go, but he the word got around. You know, Brower was told. And I don't quite know how it came about. But what happened is that some of Brower's friends on the Sierra Club, including Ansel Adams and a guy named Dick Leonard, who played a big role and was another mountain climber who climbed many peaks with Brower, they kind of rallied around and they literally decided it was time for the Sierra Club, which was founded in 1892 by John Muir. This is now 1952. Okay. They've never had a full-time employee and they've decided it's finally time we have a full-time employee. And so they work it out to essentially rescue Brower from what could have been a very dire situation. It was very private. It wasn't well known. But he was going to have trouble perhaps finding another job and explaining how he'd lost that job. So it was his friends at the Sierra Club who really rescued him.
And he said, do you figure he had a sense of loyalty to the organization because of that? I mean, it could have been disaster.
Oh, he had an intense loyalty. I mean, he had Sierra Club blood running through him for his entire life. Even, you know, he always believed that what he was doing was right for the Sierra Club. Ann Brower, the wife, would get upset because he would spend enormous amounts of time working for the club, both before he became executive director and after he became executive director. She thought that once he got the job that maybe he would slow down and not do as much volunteer work. But then he got the job and he worked even harder on the job.
Robert Wiss is with us. His book is The Man Who Built the Sierra Club, A Life of David Brower. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the complicated life and legacy of David Brower, who, of course, was one of the founders of the modern environmental movement. When he first became head of the Sierra Club, it was for birdwatchers and hikers, Robert Wiss says. He transformed it into a social and political force. Robert Wiss's new book is called The Man Who Built the Sierra Club, A Life of David Brower. He's joining us to talk about it today. Give us a sense, if you would, Bob, what the conservation movement was like in those early days. You describe it as this way, small, splintered, and kind of ineffective.
We're talking 1952. Yeah. So 1952, there might have been a handful of organizations that had any employees at all, the Sierra Club joining the list for the first time. It was garden clubs, bird watchers, civic organizations, women's organizations. It was very small, many small organizations spread around the country with, as you could understand when I say garden clubs and bird lovers, with very little political power, especially in a place like Washington.
And explain the culture. This is also an important thing to point about, to point out, because you mentioned at the time this was in the days engineers would essentially build dams wherever they wanted. Foresters were chopping trees without much restraint, and even national park rangers weren't really thought of as conservationists. They were throwing garbage to bears in parks. So give us a sense of, because that's another important piece of context, I think.
Engineers were one of the great heroes of the West in the 20th century. I mean, they built Bonneville, Boulder, Grand Coulee. They were the ones who were taming the great rivers and bringing civilization to America, particularly in the West. This brought cheap electricity. It brought water to a part of the country that was very sparse and needy of water. And for the politicians, it would... It was a form of pork barrel politics that where they could, you know, benefit from it in a number of different ways. Mm. So those are the dam builders, very, very powerful, pretty much get what they want in 1952. The Park Service is been around at that point for about 40 years. They would struggle at times to get enough people to get into the parks. So they would have, you know, almost these carnival acts at times where they would have, you know, special social occasions where they would invite all the guests to come out and watch when they fed the bears. They would Yosemite, the village of Yosemite had tennis courts, swimming pools, dancing, restaurants. It was as much there for the social activities and the recreational activities as it was for the great beauty of understanding and exploring Yosemite.
When does Brower first start to become this activist we come to recognize? I mean, he was a big believer, you write, in the 1950s of compromise, or at least it seemed that way. I mean, he told the board at the Sierra Club that it didn't make sense to just be against every dam that was proposed. He seemed willing to, like, let's work with these people. There needs to be more of a give and take.
Brower's environmental or conservation ethos grows slowly, okay? He has almost none when he joins the Sierra Club in the early 30s. He's there to climb mountains.
Right.
After World War II and when he sees what's happened in Europe, particularly in the mountains and places like that where there's been overdevelopment, he begins to change and realize what needs to happen. The pivotal moment, I would say, is what happened right in your backyard at Dinosaur National Monument in the period of 1952, well, 53, 54, 55, where essentially the dam builders want to come in to Dinosaur and they want to build two dams, one at Echo Park and one in Split Mountain. And it's part of a 10 or 12 dam complex that they want to build. It has enormous, enormous political support among the Western politicians. Everybody sees it as a win-win, except for this small group of conservationists. Brower gets lucky to go down the Green and Yampa River and sees the beauty and seizes on the idea, along with a number of others, that they have to try and save Dinosaur. And one of the principal reasons is Dinosaur has already been set aside as a national monument. You're trying to build dams inside something that's been set aside as one of the great shrines in this country. So they go to Washington, and there's these congressional hearings that occur in 1954 and 1955. And the dam builders make their case. It's a very strong case. And the conservationists get up and they make their case. And it's mostly based on the beauty. And you have to preserve the beauty of these canyons. Brower takes that argument, but then he takes it a step further. Right. And here's where the gamble occurs, yeah. Okay? There's this kind of arcane issue about evaporation rates, something that nobody quite understands, and whether the evaporation rates are better if you build these two dams or if you build a larger dam downstream in a place called Glen Canyon that nobody has ever heard of.
Right.
And Brower discovers that there's been a math mistake. And the premise that the dam builders have is that it's much better to build these dams in Dinosaur than it is to do it at Glen Canyon. And Brower discovers it's not true. But everybody tells him, you can't do this. I mean, these guys have slide rulers. These guys are God. Nobody's going to listen to you, especially on an issue like math. He ignores the advice, says what he has to say. Nobody believes him. But then a couple months later...
Wait. Go back, because he gets out a chalkboard.
Yes. Yes.
That little piece of theater. I thought that was kind of cool.
I mean, he gives the numbers the first day, and everybody's just, what? What did he say?
Yeah.
And all these congressmen. And so they say, okay, we'll recess until tomorrow morning. Then they come back the next day, and there's this chalkboard up. And first they ask the guy from the Bureau of Reclamation to go up and put a bunch of numbers on there. And then they ask Brower to come up. And so he puts his numbers up there. And you know, they're still totally they can't believe it. They just can't believe that somebody would take on the power of the Bureau of Reclamation over a math issue. But ultimately, the Bureau caves in.
Yeah.
Ultimately, the Bureau, a couple months later, caves in and says, oh, we did make a mistake. And this really had a huge impact on both the congressmen, but it also had a huge impact on the conservation community, who now felt that, my God, we've got some power here. We've got them on the run a little bit. And so they built up their power, and they built up their campaign. And ultimately, the dam builders realized, you know, this is a losing proposition. We're not going to win. And so they eventually caved in. Mm-hmm. On the Dinosaur thing. It was a massive, massive victory for the conservation community, the biggest one they'd had in decades.
Yeah. But it eventually then turns out to be David Brower's greatest defeat. This is such a crucial moment.
Yep.
Brower decides to accept a compromise. He suggests that they build a higher dam downstream on the Colorado in Glen Canyon here in Utah. And this is also crucial, I think, and I want you to work us through this, Robert Wiss. He had never been to Glen Canyon,
mm-hmm.
And it was something that haunted him, and he regrets. He regrets the whole thing. Tell this part of the story, if you would.
So, it's hard to tell if Brower knew the stakes when he was making this deal. But certainly people like the Western author Wallace Stegner, who had grown up in Utah and was part of the Dinosaur campaign, was among the people who told Brower, you know, Glen Canyon is a pretty nice place. You got to be a little careful here. And there were people who were trying to make Glen Canyon into a national park or a national monument. And Brower didn't know what to think of those things. The bottom line is, at the time he made the deal, Dinosaur has recognition from the government that it's part of the national park system as a national monument. Glen Canyon, one of the most isolated areas in the country, at least at that time, nobody knows anything about. Hardly anybody has any maps or anything about Glen Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
So he makes the deal, even though some of the Congress people say, you've got these people on such a run, you could probably get Glen Canyon defeated too. But he doesn't move further on that.
Yeah.
Then he goes down the river, and discovers.
After he makes the compromise.
After he makes the compromise, right. He goes down the river. In fact, he will make several trips down the river and finds this spectacular, spectacular wilderness. He commissions a book. He starts a campaign to try and to stop Glen Canyon, but it's really too late. I mean, the government has spent, millions and millions of dollars on this project. He goes in and talks to Stuart Udall at the time when the dam has been completed and they're going to start filling the dam and the reservoir is going to take like 18 years to fill. And Udall says, there's nothing I can do about it at this particular point. So, I mean, this, Brower will look back at this and say this is really what changed him is more than anything. This is probably what changed him.
Called it his greatest sin. Is that right?
Yep.
Explain that, because how that changed him, because the idea of compromise, he saw that differently, and explain how that changes then his ethic, because it defined the rest of his life.
Right. Well, when he argued for compromise in the early years when he was first there, he said, if we're against everything, we're just not going to have any credibility in Congress. We just need to be able to make deals at times. And then he loses Glen Canyon. He comes up with a new position. And actually, I've got a quote here which kind of typifies exactly what his position was. He said, "Conservationists have to win again and again and again. The enemy only has to win once. We are not out for ourselves. We can't win. We can only get a stay of execution. That is the best we can hope for." In other words, they're always going to be fighting these campaigns. But once they lose one of these things, once they lose a campaign like Glen Canyon, they've lost it irrevocably forever, at least in the near future for the next few generations, and it's just gone. And so that became one of his strongest standards that he would abide by for the rest of his career. And it really represented his implacable opposition to any kind of development at a certain point.
Bob Wyss is with us, journalism professor at the University of Connecticut. His new book is called The Man Who Built the Sierra Club, A Life of David Brower. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Robert Wyss. We're talking about his new book, The Man Who Built the Sierra Club, A Life of David Brower. Bob, what were his gifts? One of the things you mentioned is that he really succeeded because he was able to make people care, which gets us to the sort of his kind of genius use of media. Talk about this part of his life.
Well, I mean, we talk about how he was shy, but at the same time, he was charismatic. Yeah. If he could get before an audience, he could be spellbinding. He was a very, very good speaker. He cared about his subjects. He made his listeners care about his subjects. He was very good expressing himself verbally. He was very good at expressing himself through the written word, and he was also very good at expressing himself or the ideals he believed in through media. And in particular, his great successes, particularly at the Sierra Club, were a series of books he produced called exhibit format books, and then later with these full-page newspaper advertisements, which were incredibly effective in changing viewpoints. The books, they began when Ansel Adams had an exhibit at Yosemite, and both Ansel and Brower wanted to turn the exhibit into a book. He went to the book publishers in New York and asked them, and they turned him down. They said it would be too expensive. Nobody would buy them. You'd have to really reduce the quality. So Brower wouldn't listen to them. Brower convinced the Sierra Club board to spend enormous amounts of money to produce the first of the books by Ansel Adams. This is The American Earth. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be a colossal success. It turned out that for really quality photographs that people would pay big bucks. It was $20, $25 in those days, but in these days we're talking close to $200 to buy these books. And Ansel Adams and Elliot Porter, the mm-hmm. the photography and particularly the color photography that Elliot Porter could do and that Brower could find a publisher to print these books with, the color was just beyond what anybody had ever seen back in the 1960s. And they really built the Sierra Club. They built the membership. The Sierra Club went from 6,500 members in 52 when Brower takes over to something like 75,000 members by 1969. The budget goes from $100,000 to $3 million. And it's the books which are really driving the success and the popularity of the Sierra Club. And the books are called An Elegant Propaganda right. for Conservation.
It's, you mentioned these full-page ads that he purchased. For example, in the New York Times in 1966, he, of course, regrets pretty quickly making this compromise on Glen Canyon, trying to do what he can to stop that. Doesn't, of course, end up doing it. But are these the Sistine Chapel ads?
That, yeah, the, yeah, for the Grand Canyon. Now, it's hard to believe, but back in the 60s, they wanted to put dams in the Grand Canyon. They wanted to put two dams in the Grand Canyon. In fact, if you go back far enough into the 40s, you'll see a plan where they actually wanted to build a tunnel around the Grand Canyon to funnel the water quicker to the second dam, and it would have left virtually like 3% of the flow of the Colorado would have been left in the Grand Canyon.
Wow.
So there were some really wild plans in the Grand Canyon. And Brower, he takes over that campaign in the mid-1960s, and he's really struggling to get people interested in it. People don't seem to grasp the significance of it until finally he puts out these advertisements. And when he puts the first advertisement out, the dam opponents, particularly people like Mo Udall, who was a congressman from Arizona at the time, are just absolutely furious. And so they call up the IRS. Somebody calls up the IRS. It's a little bit in dispute whoever called up the IRS.
Somebody did.
And somebody did. And said, you know, I thought the Sierra Club was a nonprofit and not allowed to do political lobbying. And isn't this political lobbying? So the next day, after that first ad ran about the Grand Canyon, the Sierra Club has a guy from the IRS knock on their doors and saying, you're now under investigation for potential violation of your nonprofit status. So they get the message to Brower, and Brower immediately knows what to do. He puts out a press release which says, the federal government is trying to censor us. The federal government is trying to destroy the Sierra Club because we don't like their dams. This is a blatant violation of the First Amendment. And people went absolutely nuts. I mean, the newspapers, there were editorials, there were telegrams, there were letters that were pouring into Congress. Everybody was excited about this, and they were only excited in one side, that really the government was doing something really, really nasty to these conservationists. And that was really the beginning of the end of the Grand Canyon Project.
1966 is kind of the apex of David Brower's sort of power with the Sierra Club. But you write in the book, 3 years later, he's gone. What happens? I mean, it's complicated, obviously, but
it's
complicated. It's so complicated. He's really controlling. One of his most used expressions, you say, was follow me.
Yes.
So he was a control freak. But he was also a terrible business with the business part. He wanted to expand. He wanted to go into London. He struggled with these book contracts. I mean, there are all kinds of things happening. Give us a sense of essentially what happens. He falls out with the board.
Well, you know, he's been brilliant in everything, in a lot of the stuff he's done. I mean, the political campaigns, the campaigns to save Dinosaur, to save Grand Canyon are all brilliantly run. The books are just great. But of course, the books are a huge gamble, and they're a big financial gamble because they're very, very costly. And every time they produce one, they have to sell a certain number of books to pay off the cost of that book so they can build, they can publish another book. You know, it's tough to say about Brower's financial management issues. What I think he is was financially indifferent. He valued the campaigns and the fight a lot more than he valued having to raise the money or having to worry, frankly, about balancing the budget. Yeah. Now, he argued differently, but you just see it. You see it in the numbers. I mean, the Sierra Club was in the red the last few years. The books were having trouble. And if you go a few years forward, you find these very weird financial decisions he made when he started a new organization called Friends of the Earth, where one of the things he wound up doing was he came up with this idea to borrow money from essentially supporters and members of Friends of the Earth. And it wasn't a campaign to, can you give me a contribution? Can you give me money? Please loan us money and we will pay you back. And when things are going, and he got a lot of people to do that. Well, eventually, a lot of that money was never ever paid back. There were huge amounts of money that had to be written off by Friends of the Earth. So you see this throughout his career. It's kind of painful to see it, but it's one of the things that happened. And then. You know, the board starts to worry. People like Ansel Adams, who helped hire him, begin to worry more and more about what's going on. And they're starting to worry about the financial integrity of the Sierra Club and whether it's going to survive and whether Brower is the one that we want at the helm to be able to do it. And then the acts which have to border close on insubordination begin to happen. With Diablo Canyon, which is another big fight, with the board is split on the nuclear power plant, his expansion to London, and let me just give you one example here of a fight he had. So they have this IRS fight over their tax status, and so the Sierra Club hires a lawyer. And the lawyer says, I think the only way to do this is a very limited administrative appeal. Brower wants a very expensive campaign, and the lawyer says, well, that's going to cost you millions of dollars. Do you want to spend your money on legal fees, or do you want to spend your money on conservation? So the board goes with the lawyer. So a few months go by. The lawyer makes his case. He goes down to D.C., and Brower tries to convince the board to let him go to D.C. with the lawyer, and the board says no. The lawyer goes to D.C., makes his argument, goes to lunch, and he gets a call from the Treasury Department, from the IRS at lunch. And they said, you better come back. We have this really weird telegram we got from David Brower. And he goes back and he reads this telegram. And essentially the telegram says that you have this very good lawyer who's making this case, but essentially you shouldn't be listening to him. I mean, words to that effect. You really should be having this big First Amendment issue, and you should be bringing all these people. And he not only sent the telegram to the Treasury Department, he sent it to like 50 other people, congressmen, conservation groups, the press. And so it totally undercut the lawyer and the board, and there were a lot of examples where Brower was going up against the board, and the board was getting more and more angry.
You write about his last years that he turned to be, you say, more a sage than a messiah. And I wanted to ask about the story you tell toward the end of the book. He's meeting with the writer Mark Dowie. David Brower is, and Dowie's hoping that Brower is going to write a blurb for a book that he's writing, and so they meet together. And it turns out to be this, you mentioned, like this kind of two-hour harangue. And you say it revealed the way Brower was thinking in the last years of his life, that he kind of felt mistreated, that he wasn't being given the proper amount of credit. And it does raise the question, why isn't Brower, because this is something you mention in the book, why isn't Brower thought of in the same way as Aldo Leopold or Rachel Carson or John Muir? Why do you figure?
You know, I really don't understand that myself. I mean, I have I've struggled with that because I really truly believe Brouwer was really one of the great giants. I mean, in the announcement about the talk today, the radio compares him to Rachel Carson, and I think that's very valid. I think you could compare him with John Muir. You could compare him with Henry David Thoreau. He was a person ahead of his time. He was a person who was a visionary. He was a person who seized on tools and methods and mechanisms to promote what was the conservation movement and in the 1970s became the environmental movement. And he really laid the groundwork for a lot of that stuff. But, I think that defeat in 1969 was so crucial to hurting his reputation. And, I guess it was inevitable that he was going to lose that position because he just was clashing so much. He would not compromise. He just couldn't concede at all. And if he just could have conceded a little bit, he would have kept the power. He would have kept the throne of the Sierra Club, which was by far the most powerful and forceful and dynamic environmental organization of the time, at a time when the whole movement was blossoming and changing and bringing in millions and millions of new followers and tremendously new laws that were there to protect the environment.
A case of opportunities lost is kind of how you put it.
Yes.
Robert Wiss, his book is The Man Who Built the Sierra Club, A Life of David Brouwer, joined us from the studios of Connecticut Public Broadcasting in Hartford. Robert, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KEWR News. The program is technical direction from Tim Slover. Emily Anderson is our intern. The program is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.